Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. On March 13, 2019, NASA called an end of mission to the Opportunity rover, which had been exploring the surface of Mars since January of 2003. It was a mission that was supposed to last for 3 months, but it continued on for nearly 15 years before contact was lost with the rover on June 10, 2018. During that time, Opportunity, or Oppy to her friends, made significant discoveries about the presence of liquid water on the surface of Mars in the ancient past, and it set records for distance covered on another world. Later on in the show, we're going to talk to Jacob Margolis, science reporter for NPR affiliate KPCC in Pasadena. Margolis has covered the rover mission for years, but his tweet, "My batteries are low and it's getting dark," went viral and spawned an amazing public response to the end of the mission. But first, let's visit with John Callis. He's the project manager for the Mars exploration rovers Spirit and Opportunity. Spirit's mission ended in January of 2010, but Opportunity drove on around its neighborhood in Meridiani Planum until 2018. Callis joins us from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena via Skype. John Callis, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'd kind of like to start at the beginning. How did you become the project manager? When did that start for you? When did your relationship with this rover mission start?
Well, my relationship with the mission started at the very beginning in July of 2000 when the project was established. And I began serving the project as the science manager. And I was the science manager all through development and then through the first 2 years of operations. And then I was asked to be the deputy project manager and then eventually the project manager. So I've been the project manager for the last 12 years of the 14-year extended mission.
And the launch date was in 2003, as I recall. And we've been following this mission ever since this show was called the Blue Dot Report back in the day. And it was only 4 minutes long. And so, I kind of feel like, in a way, we've grown up with this mission.
Yes, yeah, so, a lot of people have similar experiences. We have many people on the project who have children that have grown up with this project. And they've always known that there's been a rover on Mars. And so this is the first time that there hasn't been either Spirit or Opportunity. They're children's rover mates, if you will.
And, I'd kind of like to talk a little bit about there is definitely an attachment that you get to these machines. They're not living things. They're machines. But we do become attached, especially for engineers and scientists who are working with a wonderful machine like Opportunity that was designed to only last, 90 sols, 3 months, and lasted for 15 years. You get an attachment to this. And what I'd like to ask you about is, our friend Jacob Margolis, who was happened to be our guest last week, we were talking about his podcast, The Big One. He tweeted out something where he was just paraphrasing what he'd heard from scientists, where he said, my battery is low and it's getting dark. And of course, that went viral as if Opportunity had actually spoken those words. Could you explain to us exactly kind of what happened there and set the record straight?
Back in early June, we got report of a dust storm, a regional dust storm on Mars. But it was only a small regional storm at the time, and literally within days, it turned into this raging global dust storm that completely darkened the skies over the rover. And so there was little we could do for the rover at that point, and the rover reported each day what the energy levels were, the amount of sunlight it was receiving, and it was dropping each day. And the last report we got was an incredibly dark sky. I mean, it was nighttime during the day. For the rover, and the rover had very little energy and certainly not enough to keep it going. And so it would inevitably deplete its batteries. And that was the last communication we got. So yes, it was going dark and its batteries were being depleted.
But it didn't literally send out those words in English. It was just data.
Rover spacecraft numerical engineering telemetry, the information the rover sent us.
Yeah, because on Twitter, people made it sound like it actually said those words. And let's go back to the beginning and remind us about entry, descent, and landing about how you got these rovers down to the surface of Mars? Because it was kind of a brand new thing, and amazing the way you bounced your way into a crater. Was it Eagle Crater, I think you wound up in? Could you tell us a bit about the landing?
Of course. Landing on Mars is hard. And what makes it hard is you don't know exactly where you're going to touch down, and you don't know what kind of hazards there are where you touch down. And so you try to design a system that can be resilient to a wide variety of hazards, sloping terrain, sharp pointy rocks, crevices, soft material. And the rover's entry, descent, and landing system, which includes a combination of heat shield, parachute, retro rockets, and then airbags that eventually slow the vehicle down and land it safely on the surface. Because when we arrive at Mars, we're going something more than 12,000 miles per hour relative to the planet. So we have to get rid of all that speed in order to land. And we get rid of most of it by streaming through the atmosphere and using atmospheric drag to slow us down. And then once we get down to about the speed of sound, Mach 1, we deploy our parachute, and that slows us down. And then eventually we use retro rockets to kind of slam the brakes on at the last minute, but it's the airbags that provide the final cushion of the rover against the surface of Mars. And we probably hit the ground at going about 50 miles an hour, which is where airbags in your car are designed to keep you safe. The vehicle rolls when it hits the ground. I mean, it bounces and rolls like a giant beach ball, so you can't determine where it's going to end up. And in the case of Opportunity, it rolled into this small crater called Eagle Crater. It's about 20 meters in diameter. And so it was kind of like a hole-in-one, because it was at the rib of that crater where the rover made its very first but significant scientific discovery.
Yes, and tell us about that. Is that where you found the so-called blueberries?
Yes. Exposed in the rim of this small crater was a rock outcrop. And when the rover drove over to it and examined it, we found that it was layered rocks, laminated rocks. These are aqueous minerals. So these rocks were formed in water. And this was the first physical, conclusive evidence that there was sustained liquid water on the surface of Mars. You know, we've speculated for all of human history that there was liquid water on Mars. Today, we only can confirm the presence of ice and water vapor, not liquid. And we've seen flow channels that look awfully similar to flowing water on Mars, carved by flowing water, but we didn't know for sure. Opportunity gave us that absolute assurance that it was liquid water by seeing the morphology, how the rocks look, these laminated rocks, that they're layered, they're formed in water, and also by establishing the chemistry of the rocks, which confirmed that these minerals formed in water. And not just, you know, quickly overnight, but it takes geologic time. And so this means that there was liquid water, stable water on the surface of Mars for very long periods of time, 10,000 years, 10 million years. And because we're a rover and we continue to drive and find the signature of water, we know that these bodies of water were not just ponds or puddles, but kilometer scale bodies of water on the surface of Mars. And so that's one of the big scientific legacies of Opportunity's mission.
Well, take us along on that journey from Eagle Crater, because the next stop was at Endurance Crater, as I recall. And give our listeners a sense of how fast or not fast the rover is going. And does it still hold the record for the greatest distance traveled by a rover?
I'll answer the last question first. Yes, Opportunity holds the greatest off-Earth driving distance record, over 45 kilometers. And it's probably going to be a very long time before someone else beats that record. But you could characterize this mission as the crater-hopping mission, because we drove from where we landed, Eagle Crater, to Endurance Crater, then to eventually Victoria Crater, then ultimately Endeavour Crater. But Endurance Crater was the first big crater we visited. It's about 150 meters in diameter. It took us about 70 days to get there. And the rover doesn't move very fast. It moves about as fast as a tortoise. We would typically go of the order of 100 meters a day with a rover. But Endurance Crater is where we decided to drive down into the crater because, you know, a crater is a big hole in the ground and the rocks at the bottom are older than the rocks at the top. So by going down into the crater, you could get to go back in time. But we never designed this rover to go into a crater. We knew we could go down it, but we wanted to make sure we could come back out again. We didn't want it to be a one-way mission. And so before we drove down in, we actually did ground testing here at JPL. We rushed to the local home center. We bought a whole bunch of lumber and those paving stones that your spouse wants you to make the patio in the backyard with. And we built a giant tilt table with the paving stones on it. We covered it with sand and small rocks and used a crane to lift it up to create various slopes. And then we took our test rover and we drove it up and down this thing to confirm that we could get into Endurance Crater safely and get back out again safely. And then we went down inside and essentially read the chapters of the Martian history book in reverse order.
And could you briefly summarize for us what were some of the findings from reading that history book?
Well, it told us that Mars has had an episodic history and that there have been periods in which Mars was wet and then periods when Mars was dry and periods when it's been wet again, perhaps in different ways. Not unlike the Death Valley, where you might have these persistent shallow lakes that exist from season to season. And then you might go through a decade where it's completely dry. And then later on, you might have persistent lakes again. Mars is kind of like that in its early history. There are times in which there was sustained liquid water on the surface and times in which it was gone. And then times in which liquid water percolated up from within the interior of the planet to the surface. So a dynamic environment.
You mentioned Death Valley, and that brought to mind for me that when you go to a place like Death Valley, you find these chemical rocks that are evaporites, that are things where there's water that has chemicals in it, salts, and then the water evaporates and it leaves those things behind, but which is evidence that there was water there. And didn't you also find a gypsum deposit in one of the craters?
Yes, as we headed to Endeavor Crater, we did come across these gypsum veins. And so this is part of this episodic history I mentioned where you had cracks that had formed in the geology and then water percolated up and you had these evaporites that formed in the cracks. So yeah, gypsum.
You also mentioned worrying about when you went into Endurance Crater about worrying about getting out. You did have an episode, I believe it was in 2005, where didn't the rover get stuck in some sand dunes?
Yes, we call that Purgatory Dune. We were young and naive and driving recklessly like teenagers across the surface of Mars with our new rover. And we didn't appreciate the hazards that these blown, wind-blown ripples represent. And the rover just had been just sort of driving over these things, much like you drive a buggy over sand dunes at the beach. But on one of these that was particularly hard, the rover literally plowed into it. I mean, the wheels, instead of climbing over it, started to dig into it. And because we had sequenced what we call blind drive, which is we just tell the rover to spin the wheels. We don't pay attention to, we don't have the rover monitor its progress while it's doing that because we thought it would just safely and quickly pass through this area. It actually dug into this dune and buried itself up to the hubcaps on the wheels. So we had to spend a lot of time figuring out how to get the rover unstuck. And we did that by recreating that situation here on the ground in our test lab and using our engineering rover, sticking it into the simulated soil, burying it to its hubcaps, and then trying to get it out. And what we found is the best way to get out is just put it into reverse and gun it, which is, you know, just spin the wheels backwards. We had to spin them a long time, but eventually the rover popped out again.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to our look back at the Opportunity rover mission with John Callis, Mars Exploration Rover's project manager. Stay with us.
Thank you.
we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return to our conversation with John Callis. He was the project manager for the Opportunity Rover mission on Mars. This is also a good time to remind our listeners that this isn't like driving a rover that you have in front of you. This is a rover that's millions of miles away. And there's a huge time delay that you have to deal with. So you can't just tell it in real time, you know, do this, do that. You have to send up commands, and then it's got to follow those. Could you just give us a sense of how that works?
That's right. You know, the alignment of Earth and Mars is such that a radio signal coming from Earth takes anywhere between 5 minutes and 21 minutes to reach Mars, and then the corresponding amount of time to come back. So we can't control these rovers in real time. So, you know, I don't have a room filled with teenagers and game consoles who are driving the rover. Instead, we plan the rover's activities every day. The rover would sleep during the night to save energy, would wake up in the morning, and then we would tell it what to do, and it would autonomously, on its own, carry out those instructions over the course of the day. Sometimes those instructions are very explicit, and the rover doesn't have to do much thinking to carry them out. Other times, we tell the rover, well, just do this, and the rover has to figure out how to do it. So it's, we can apply different levels of autonomy to the rover's activities.
And that also brings up another interesting aspect for you and everyone on your team, is you're dealing with what's called a sol, which is a Martian day, which is a bit different from an Earth day. And that causes this time slipping where, you know, you're not going to work at the same time every day. Could you tell us just a little bit about the challenges that presents for people, you know, socially as well as, you know, scientifically and engineering wise?
A Martian day, or sol as we call it, is just about 24 hours and 40 minutes long. And since the rover works on Mars time, or Martian sols, you know, being solar powered, the rover's activities would shift by 40 minutes each day. So for the original prime mission, the first 3 months of the mission, we actually had humans here on Earth working on Mars time, which meant their workday would shift by 40 minutes. Now, one way you can think about it is that you can sleep in an extra 40 minutes every single day. The reality is you're in a permanent state of jet lag because your body never gets a chance to adjust to what time of day it is. So sometimes you're working when it's nighttime here on Earth, and you're trying to sleep during the day when the rest of the world is up and about. So, you know, I mean, I think any one of us have tried to sleep during the day when the landscaper is outside with a leaf blower, and you just can't do it. So it was very difficult. So after the prime mission of 3 months, we transitioned off back onto a nearly regular Earth time schedule. What that meant is that we wouldn't always be able to respond to the rover every day, but we could certainly respond every couple of days. And so we went into this phase where for about 2 weeks every month, we would be what we call restricted, which means that we would be speaking to the rover essentially every 2 days. And then for the other 2 months of the of that period, excuse me, 2 weeks of that month, we could speak to the rover every day, plan every day. So we went through the cycle continuously for, you know, 14 and a half years.
Well, this rover amazingly lasted so much longer than anyone could have imagined. Could you briefly tell us why that is? Did it have something to do with Mars winds and things that actually aided you in keeping this rover going?
Well, you know, there are a number of things that contribute to that. We had exquisitely built machines, but as you indicate, one of the things we didn't expect on Mars is that wind would occasionally come along and blow some of the dust that would accumulate on the solar arrays. This is what we thought would end the mission, would be that over a period of about 90 days, the dust that rains out of the atmosphere would just collect on the solar arrays and eventually, you know, shut off the power. But as luck would have it, the wind would blow most of the dust off and the rover would keep going. The other important thing is that we had perhaps the finest batteries in the solar system on these rovers. These are lithium-ion batteries that work so well, even after 14 and a half years and over 5,000 charge discharge cycles, these batteries had about 85% of their capacity remaining, which is just phenomenal because, you know, the battery in your cell phone doesn't seem to last a month before you need to get it replaced or have it charged all the time. So that really, so the combination of having excellent batteries and the continued cleaning of the solar arrays. The other is, you know, I was fortunate to lead a incredibly gifted, innovative, and dedicated team of engineers that could solve pretty much any problem that came along for the rovers. And that's the other reason why they lasted so long. We had, you know, a great team of stewards who are just keeping a close eye on this rover and doing all that we can to keep it going as long as we could.
Can you tell us what it was like or when you kind of finally, you know, your team realized and, you know, kind of how that felt when it's like it's not going to be revived. We're not going to be able to get Opportunity back online again. This mission is basically over.
It was a slow process because the best chance to hear from the rover was right after the dust storm cleared. And with each passing day, our hopes sunk a little bit each day, and it kept going. And, you know, we were hopeful, but that hope diminishes. It's not unlike, you know, you have a beloved pet that disappears. The best time to find the pet or to have the pet come home is shortly after the disappearance. But with each passing day, the chance of them coming home decreases. And it was very much like that. And it made it hard because even to this day, we still don't know what happened to the rover. So it's hard to say goodbye when you don't know why you're saying goodbye.
Yes, and as we mentioned earlier, it is a machine, but you do get attached to it and mostly to each other, going to work together on a project like this. That's one of NASA's most successful missions of all time, certainly ranks up there with any mission like Cassini or Voyager. Could you just briefly tell us, what do you think the legacy is of the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, and OPI in particular?
Well, this was their first overland exploration on the surface of another world. This is the first time the human species got to do that kind of exploration. But it was also a sustained exploration. I mean, since January of 2004 till today, still going with other rovers, we have had a sustained presence on the surface of Mars. I have had a team working on Mars for the last 14 and a half years. So in one sense, Opportunity has made us all Martians because we come to work on Mars every day, or we had been. I mean, there's still a team that's working Curiosity on Mars. So in one sense, Opportunity made our species Martians and made our world larger, because our world no longer just includes the Earth, it now includes the surface of Mars. So we live in a larger universe because of this rover.
And Opportunity took some just incredible images, beautiful images of the surface of Mars. Is there one that's your favorite?
There are so many. One in particular is when we're on the rim of Endeavour Crater, and we're looking north from the direction in which we came. And you can see the rover's wheel tracks coursing along the rim of the crater, and they disappear into the distance. And it just speaks of how far this rover has come and the kind of exploration that it performed over these 14 and a half years. It's kind of a lonely image, but it's prophetic in that respect.
Well, John Callis, thanks so much for sharing your expertise and memories of this mission you've overseen all these 15 years, and sharing with us the legacy of this incredible mission, the Opportunity Rover. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks to our guest, John Callis, Mars Exploration Rover's Project Manager for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk to journalist Jacob Margolis about his take on the rover mission and the tweet he sent out that went viral. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Jacob Margolis, science journalist for KPCC, an NPR affiliate in Southern California, and the host of the Big One podcast. His tweet about opportunity went viral, and we'll talk to him about that for sure. He joins us from KPCC in Pasadena. Jacob Margolis, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be back on so quickly. It's great.
Yeah, me too. Well, I just need to start with this. My battery is low and it's getting dark.
You know, that's how I feel almost every single day. It's true.
I mean, if for our listeners who don't know, which is like, I guess if you don't follow Twitter much, you know, you wouldn't know. But if you do, can you lead us through, you know, the process of, you know, how you came about putting this tweet out there and how it went literally viral? And then we'll talk a little bit about the sequence of events after that.
Yeah, if I pretended like I had any sort of like overall mission to get something to go viral, that would be an 100% absolute lie. I'm not a fantastic social media person, but you know, I had a heads up from JPL that opportunity, there was going to be a last shot at trying to get it to respond to some of their commands before they were going to potentially call the mission. And so maybe 10 minutes, maybe an hour before this was announced to the public, I just wrote up a quick thread and I said, hey, look, like tonight between 8 p.m. and midnight, basically, this is the last shot. And here's what happened. There was a giant dust storm on Mars, Opportunity, which had been rolling around doing really well for a lot longer than anticipated, like 14 plus years. You know, it could be over. And people have built this really strong connection with Opportunity. And so, you know, I had spoken to a couple scientists and they told me that basically the last communication they had with the rover was that its battery was low and it was getting dark. And that was kind of, that was a phrase that I put out there. And it was a culmination of multiple interviews with different scientists, including John Callis, who was working on the mission, and Abigail Freeman, both of which spent a long time talking to me about it. And both of which were very emotional about this. And so I felt like that was a fair way to describe the final moments. You know, a little bit of anthropomorphization, I think, can be very effective in communicating science stuff to people as well.
Yes, but you know, it literally doesn't say words. It just sends back data that, yeah, you know, lets them know that, you know, the power levels are very low, and you know, the light sensors are sensing that, you know, there's a dust storm coming and it's dark. And so you just turn that into this very poetic saying. When did you start to see that this thing is really blowing up?
Yeah, it was crazy. I posted it. It didn't really do much for a couple of hours. I think it was like some likes coming in, and I don't know what finally kicked it off, but people went absolutely nuts for it, at least in what I consider nuts, you know, not compared to like a very famous person's tweets. But I think as of now, it's had close to 40,000 likes, 20,000 plus retweets. And most of the responses are like, I'm crying, I'm having a really difficult time with this. Celebrities retweeted it, which I think that helped a lot. And including, I think it was Patton Oswalt, George Takei, Joss Whedon, Alyssa Milano. And, you know, they were clearly into it too, which also helps it reach a very broad audience. But I think the thing that really kept people around, kept them coming back or sharing it or whatever, was that feeling of like, I can relate to this machine that is on this mission for us on Mars, this like pure rover that just was there to help expand human knowledge. And I think a lot of people find that to be a very beautiful existence for the rover and very grateful for the rover. And the fact that it ended this way is sad.
Yes. And I saw somebody even had a tattoo made.
Yeah, that was kind of the... That's kind of where it peaked for me, was I saw that someone has a tattoo of a rover. I don't know if it is actually Opportunity. It might be Curiosity, but it says the phrase, my battery is low and it is getting dark. And I actually think it looks really great. So I'm really happy that someone was that inspired, that they wanted to put that on their body permanently. And I think the phrase has also resonated with a lot of people, because I think we feel that in everyday life quite often. My battery is low and it's getting dark. And, you know, a little bit of maudlin kind of phrase. But yeah, I think people can kind of relate to that a little bit.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, one of the things that makes you a really fine science journalist is you've got to find a way to make technical, scientific ideas accessible to the everyday person, and this did it so beautifully. But also, didn't it also get reported as literal truth that the Roe v. Act, this was its last words in some kind of news outlets?
Yeah, I think the New York Post reported it as the official phrase that it was saying. A lot of people on Twitter and on Reddit and some other websites were saying also that, oh, like, I can't believe it said this as its final phrase. And so what we had to do was on Saturday, about 4 days after I had posted that series of tweets, we decided in our newsroom that we actually needed to respond to it, that it had hit a critical mass, that people were reporting the incorrect words from the Rover. And so I clarified it on LAS.com, which is the site, one of the sites that I write for. And most people understood that it was a summation of actual response that the Rover sent back. Most people were not surprised by it, but I think people were also interested in looking and seeing like what the scientists actually said, which, you know, Abigail Freeman said, yeah, the last thing we heard was my battery is getting low, something along those lines. John Callis said, you know, we knew that it was getting dark because the Rover was telling us. And, you know, you put those together and you get an awfully sad, awfully poetic ending for a Rover, which is also what I said to John. And he was like, yeah, okay, yeah. Because I think some of these scientists are kind of, I think they're sad about the mission ending, but I think many are ready to move on. And I think that there's kind of, I don't know if they always like to anthropomorphize their machines. It's interesting to talk to them about that, though.
Well, from my experience, and it's considerable talking to them about this, because I've been covering this rover mission a long time. In fact, I saw that the Opportunity rover was on Mars longer than Facebook has been around.
Yeah, I don't even remember that far back in my life. I can only remember everything is before Facebook and after Facebook, I guess. I don't really know. Yeah, it's been around for a really long time, and it's done some pretty miraculous work. I mean, one of my earlier science memories in life, and I wasn't that young when Opportunity went up, but was actually getting to relate around the mission with my father and talk about that with him. And I think that when we have these big missions that really do help us expand our knowledge of the universe, that are these really, I mean, they're really difficult missions that maybe should not be possible. People get interested in science as a result. Abigail Freeman, who runs part of the project or ran part of the project with Opportunity, you know, she was 16 when she saw Opportunity crash land with the airbags on Mars, like right in the perfect place. And she then went through her career just with the hope of ending up on that mission and ending up at JPL. And she like tailored everything from that point forward to do that. And to me, that is the coolest thing about all this, is that one, we were able to accomplish something so grand, and two, that people feel inspired by science. They want to go into these fields. And that is why I actually like to do science journalism, because I get to dabble all over the place and talk to really smart people that are much smarter than I am.
Yes, and you don't have to do all the academic work to get the PhD to talk to all these cool people and get
100%.
What I love about what we do is we get to dabble in all of these things instead of just being kind of locked into one thing, you know, exploring the surface of Mars. You know, you and I can go off and explore the San Andreas Fault the next day.
Oh, yeah. And I think that, you know, this morning I woke up and I looked at the drought monitor for California, and it actually was positive news for once.
Yeah, it's been snowing a lot up here in Northern California. The Sierra are just loaded with snow. So that is a wonderful story. You know, you were talking about the anthropomorphizing of machine-like spirit and opportunity, the rovers. And it's kind of easy to see how people do that, because they are kind of pretty darn cute, aren't they?
I think they are cute, and I think that makes them easy to relate to. And JPL has also done a very, very good job with pushing out kind of a personality for these different rovers. And I think that was a very deliberate decision in probably the past 10 years. They've also sent a lot of scientists, and they might have always done this, but I feel like there's a particular push in the past 10 years to have a lot of scientists go through media training and stuff like that. So I have found that has made them and their missions a lot more relatable, especially even for me, you know, and it's easier to get people excited about it when you can talk about it like it is a living thing, even though obviously it's only there because humans put it there, and it only does what humans tell it to do. So it's not a living thing. It didn't technically die, but I think relating to it like that is not a bad thing. I think that's actually a positive thing for the science field.
Certainly. Well, here's my take on it from my experience being around these people for decades is it's not the machine, although they will miss that. It's each other. It's the team, because they get bonded working together day after day, year after year, sometimes for decades on a mission. And when a mission ends, like Cassini or Opportunity, they tend to start going their separate ways, and they know that, and that kind of family bonding thing, that's the part that where you sense the sadness from them, where it's very personal.
And that's what I heard, especially when I covered the end of Cassini. You know, there are these people that have been working together since like the 1980s, even the 1970s in some cases, on these missions to Saturn. And to have such a large portion of your life be so into, you know, so closely entwined with all these other people, you know, people were having like babies at the same time because they knew there would be a lull in these like certain missions. And to go through that and then all of it kind of comes to an end, and, you know, there's an event and the media covers it and then everyone moves on, you know, you're never going to be in the trenches like that again with those same people. And I think that caused, you know, that's difficult to move on from that. I know, as someone who's moved on from helping build up radio shows, it's the same kind of thing. Being in the trenches, doing important projects, and then moving on can be really tough. And, you know, the end of Opportunity is the end of that for a lot of these folks.
Well, we still have a rover Curiosity on Mars, and of course, a Mars 2020 rover. What is it that you most enjoy, you know, working there at KPCC, about getting to interact with folks at JPL to cover these missions?
Everyone's very genuine, and they're really smart, and people are just really excited to talk about science. And in my normal life, I ask a million questions, so the fact that I get paid to do it and encouraged to do it on a professional level is absolutely thrilling for me. I love, love, love my job. And when I get to ask people these like intricate questions about how these different science things work so that I can translate it to something that the audience can understand as well, you know, it gets me excited every single day. And I can't say that a lot of people have jobs like that, but I'm very happy that I found something that I feel like is my calling, honestly.
Can you think of any examples of some time, perhaps when you were going to go do an interview or a story, and, you know, you perhaps were mildly interested in it, and then afterwards was just, you know, amazed?
Yeah. Okay. I do have a story. So I cover climate change as part of my beat as well, and there was a study that came up about the collapse of California's marshes, basically along the coast, as a result of climate change. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. I wouldn't say I was super excited about it, but I went out there with the scientist, and we walked through this marsh, and he pointed out all the little crabs and the birds that were feeding on different things and all these little tiny plants. And I was out in this field, out in this marsh that you usually drive by on the one freeway, where you're just like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever, that thing. But when I was there and I was like, I was staring all these things straight in the face, I was getting caught in mud in the marsh, you know, that made it supremely, one, fun, but two, also really fascinating, and showed me just how diverse these marshes were when it came to just different types of animals and plants. And while before I went out there, I didn't really have any sort of emotional feeling about it, afterwards, I was like, oh, this would be really bad if all these things disappeared, because they're also sort of canary in the coal mine for a lot of changes along the coast. And I wrote up a whole article, did a radio piece, really was into it. And then it turns out most people don't want to click on articles about marshes, which was a bit of a bummer. But for me, I went from being to very, very excited about marsh activity. And that was something that, you know, I was happy that I got to do.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to get people to realize that. And one of the things I love about Fresh Air with Terry Gross is that so often when I hear what the topic is, my initial reaction is, I don't think I'm going to really want to listen to this one. But then I don't get around to turning it off. And, you know, 15 minutes later, she has and her guest have me engrossed in whatever that is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a recent episode about U.S. imperialism, which I'm totally into learning about. But you end up learning a lot about bat guano, the harvesting of bat guano, and it has all these, like, terrible implications for people. And there's a whole political history behind it. And I'm totally in for those kinds of conversations.
Yeah, that was just terrible to think about, those poor people stranded on those islands having to harvest.
Yeah, bat poop.
Yeah, that was bad. That was bad.
Yeah, it was awful.
Well, before we let you go, you're wrapping up the big one. How many more episodes do we have left to go?
So this week, how many more do we have? This week is our 7th episode, so we have 9 total. And this week's all about preparing for the big one and my own personal struggles when it came to preparing for it, because I think most people don't prepare and they feel guilty. I was in the exact same boat. I actually did get ready, and I show people how they can do it too. And then next week, episode 8 is really exciting because it's all about the psychology of why we don't prepare, even though we know these things are coming. Like, you know death is coming, but you might not have a will. You know a big earthquake is coming, but you probably don't have supplies. Like, why is that? And that goes for me too. I don't know. Do you have any earthquake supplies?
Well, not earthquake supplies, but, you know, because I'm not in a real seismic hazard zone up here. But I will tell you a quick story. Last summer, you know, every couple of weeks when I would be driving home through the northern Sacramento Valley, I'd look somewhere up in the mountains, and all of a sudden you would see what looked like a thunderhead. And realizing that, you know, from the weather forecast and from the meteorology of the situation, there should be no thunderheads there. And then you look at it and you realize very quickly, this is a pyrocumulus cloud from a very large wildfire blowing up. And it became such a regular experience that, you know, it was like, oh no, here comes another pyrocumulus cloud. It went on and on through the whole summer. And then one day I was inside doing some work on my computer, and Cheryl came in and from working out in the yard and said, you know, somebody just called and said there's a fire behind us. And so I ran outside, and there's a pyrocumulus cloud right out behind my house. And there was a fire within a mile of us. And it was very windy that day. And we were so fortunate. The wind was blowing, you know, laterally, not towards us. And Cal Fire just delivered this aerial armada onto it that was just amazing, with giant jet bomber after jet bomber, prop bombers. It was nonstop for hours, and they got it under control. It never got to my neighborhood, but it was close. And while this was all going on, I'm frantically running around trying to figure out, okay, what do we need? Where's this? You know, do we need papers? We need meds.
Oh man, you should have all that ready.
Yeah, it wasn't ready. And I'm having this just terrible realization that I have not prepared, even though I know I should have. And so that led to a real awakening moment for me, where it's like, okay, I need to start getting my act together. But, you know, when you're in that moment and that panicky feeling is seizing you, it's real hard to think clearly about what to do. And so that's a lesson for your listeners on the Big One podcast. Is when it happens, it's very difficult to think. So you want to have everything planned out and thought about ahead when you're not in that panicky moment.
That's a really good point.
Well, Jacob, thanks so much for sharing with us the wonderful story about your tweet. My battery is low and it's getting dark. And, you know, here's to opportunity. Oppie gave us about 15 years of marvelous exploration on Mars, one of NASA's most successful missions, really. And also still, as I believe, it holds the record for the longest rover distance. When you think back about, like, the Apollo rovers driving around and how far they went and all of the different rovers, it still holds the record at, I think, 28 miles or something like that.
That's pretty cool. I think it's the longest distance driven off planet by a vehicle.
Off planet.
In the solar system. Yeah. And I asked, well, can't you just say the universe? And they're like, we don't know about the rest of the universe.
Well, and yet we can't even say the Milky Way or, you know, the Orion arm of the Milky Way. You know, we don't really know.
Absolutely.
Because there could be other rovers out there with their batteries, whatever their battery type is, and their sensors sensing darkness. So I'll leave you on that somber note as we bid farewell to Opportunity and Jacob Margolis from KPCC. Thanks again for joining us. It was fun, as always, to talk to you.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guests, John Callis, the project manager for the Mars Exploration Rovers program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and journalist Jacob Margolis from NPR affiliate KPCC, also in that town that has the Rose Bowl. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz, and our producer engineer is Mr. Blue himself, Sky Schofield. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.